My lords, ladies and gentlemen, eminent fellows, it's a great pleasure, indeed an honor, to speak to you this evening. I've been asked to talk about the challenges of communicating the uncertainty of risk elements. And my first inclination, being a smart aleck from Kansas, is to say, well, I'm not sure, and leave it at that. But perhaps it'd be better for you if I did. We'll see you in about 19 minutes. But I'll plow on. And it seems to me, as it relates to science and life, today we know more things for certain and are also more uncertain about more things. So while the facts about life are better known than ever before, the uncertainty about our daily lives feels no less than in the past. One thing is certain. Every successful economy that has ever existed has found a way to manage risk. And risk is just a slightly cooler word for uncertainty. Formal risk transfer, when a business removes uncertainty from its balance sheet by taking out an insurance contract, has been around for centuries. The basic premise remains. The insurance industry exists to absorb other people's uncertainties so they can plan and critically grow their businesses. So in some ways, Lloyd's is a public repository of uncertainty. I often thought that we should call it the Institute for Applied Uncertainty and rely on some of your theoretical work for help, because we do rely on you. Specifically, let's look at banking and insurance. In insurance, at least at Lloyd's for the last 325 years, our underwriters have specialized in decision-making under uncertainty. Until the derivatives boom of the late 80s and early 90s, bank balance sheets were reasonably fixed and determinable. Deposits were fixed and loans were absolute amounts. With options, futures, other financial instruments and derivatives, banking institutions introduced uncertainty to their balance sheets in unprecedented ways. If you take the Black-Scholes theory and models, and Excel spreadsheets made this all possible. Having worked in a derivatives trading floor and watching a guy hit F9 on his thing and go 1,001, 1,002, too slow. I know that if you didn't have Excel spreadsheets, we might not have had 2008. So while much of the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis was down to the age-old problem of over-leveraging, a large part of the problem was down to bank boards not fully appreciating how probability-driven their financial statements actually were. But I'm not here to talk about banks, but rather insurance enterprises. These businesses are largely firms which buy and hold what I'll call jump risk. Derivatives risk largely trade on the concept there will be a continuous market for their instruments. In other words, every morning they get up and they can trade on the exchanges. Jump risk is the risk that comes from discontinuity. For example, if the Japanese stock market were to close following an earthquake and not open for 2 weeks, there would be a big gap between where it last closed and where it opened up again. And jump risks are the things that are most difficult for a derivatives trader. It's actually what they pay them the big money for. Lloyd's, we have an entire building of what you might call jump risk underwriters. They have to manage a book of risks knowing that they may go to sleep, waking up to a new disaster that has occurred with very little opportunity to hedge, manage, or mitigate that risk after the fact. So the key points I hope to get across this evening are that Lloyd's and the underwriters within it manage uncertainty, and I think we're pretty good at it. The insurance industry has tools and techniques for communicating levels of risk. And although this is somewhat hard for me to say because of my skeptical beliefs, I think we're better off with models than without them. However, we're pretty well aware that they are approximations and they have some weaknesses, which I'll discuss a little bit later in my talk. So first, a description of the key risks we try to address at Lloyd's. There's market risk, that's the movement of stocks and bonds in the marketplace is usually determinable on Bloomberg or wherever else you want to look. There's credit risk, which is the long-term extension of credit from one party to another. And then there's what I like to refer to as event, actuarial, and behavioral risk. So at Lloyd's, we tend to only look at this red circle, and occasionally the overlaps on the credit side and very little on the overlaps on the market side. And where we do take credit risk, it's usually tied to a specific trade or a project where there's some kind of event that's likely to trigger what's happening with the credit event. So as we look at these risks, to help you have some definition in terms of what we look at, I like to call event risks essentially acts of God. And actuarial risks would be those events or acts of God where we have enough data or observations where the law of large numbers may be used to determine frequency and sometimes quantum. Now, when you look at the laws and things that are passed in California, you may sometimes assume that everybody out there is an agnostic because there appear to be no more acts of God when you look at the lawsuits. And it looks to me that somebody's responsible for something. So then if you look at behavioral risks, those are the risks that where you look at the law of large numbers as it's applied to acts of human. You know, how many people buy a lottery ticket? How many people redeem those 10-year warranties on white goods? How many people buy insurance policies on electronics and such? And Lloyd's typically cover the risks that people find hard to insure in their local markets. For example, property exposures on the east coast of the U.S., which is in significant risk of hurricane damage, or property in California at risk of earthquakes. A great deal of our business is commercial risks. These may include construction projects, offshore oil platforms, major buildings owned by property companies, and aircraft, ships, professional negligence. In short, just about every aspect of the economy we seem to take some risk in. And this is the structure of the market, which I'll come back to. But if you look at these sort of things, you know, when you see something bad in the newspaper, I generally take a great deal of interest, and I can probably tell you about how much we're going to spend on it. It makes driving around in a car with me sort of unfortunate if you see a bad driver. I take down his license number to make sure we're not covering him, that sort of thing. And yes, I did used to be married. So, and I don't blame her, really. So this is why over the years we paid out on Piper Alpha, World Trade Center, Costa Concordia, Deepwater Horizon, Hurricane Katrina, Thai flooding. In fact, most disasters, in fact. There's one report I would refer you to called our Global Underinsurance Report, where unfortunately there are uninsured losses that are not that we wouldn't cover them, but the insurance penetration in a given economy is woefully low. In China, it's about 1.5%. If you looked at the Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, we might pay about $100 million out in insured losses, but the overall loss to the economy is probably well over $100 billion, and merely because it's not in the culture to buy insurance protection. So we can try and help the global economy by to manage their uncertainty by taking risks off the balance sheets and onto ours. To give you a quick sort of, well, that didn't work too well. Well, imagine the former slide, if you would, and a few facts about Lloyd's. At year-end 2013, we had 184,000 insurance policies in place. And this represents 184,000 uncertainty transfers from policyholders. These decisions were made by about 3,000 underwriters working for one of the 93 syndicates at Lloyd's. They were brokered or sold by over 7,000 Lloyd's brokers who worked for over 204, or about 204 broking firms. The premium totals for all these different risks exceeded 25 billion pounds, which is equivalent to roughly about 1.7% of the world's non-life insurance and reinsurance premium. Also at year-end, we had about 239,000 claims, which were valued at around $16.8 billion at year-end 2013, which in and of itself is a great source of uncertainty in terms of estimating what those claims will ultimately cost. Pricing is an art and increasingly a science. We need to estimate the likely costs, but with quite a bit of humility, and anybody who's been in the market as long as I have, or my colleagues in the audience, or and some underwriters who are here, you've paid for your humility quite well. And so a simple pricing formula is one of the ways we begin to think about this. And I wouldn't want to claim that any Lloyd's underwriter uses this, but I think it'll help me explain the fundamentals of our process. So the price up there says expected claims. Okay, first of all, how many years do you want to divide by to know what your expected claims are? 20, 50, 100? Then the some factor times the standard deviation. And the standard deviation, if you just truncate this formula right there, it's a paper that Rodney Krebs presented to Aston about how to price excess of loss property insurance. And I knew Rodney at the time, and he would give his speech about how this is expected claims, and that factor there he'd call the reluctance to risk times the standard deviation. So that's how people would set their pricing. And he reverse engineered from looking at some prices in the marketplace. It seemed underwriters wanted about 0.33 times the standard deviation. But he would then go on to say, unless, of course, you're Tom Bolt, who works at Berkshire Hathaway, in which case you want one. He wasn't wrong, but I couldn't understand why you wanted less. Then you have the expected expenses, also a source of volatility, depending on the length of time you're going to have the policy to work on. And then K is some rate of return you'd like times the capital held. Now, you might argue if you're using Rodney's formula, you'd throw the capital into that. But the way the regulation works nowadays, and we spent about 300 million pounds coming up with solvency models to calculate our internal exposures as well as what the rest of the organizational risks are. We've used the risk register and applied that. And there's also the PRA would like us to do another more manual calculation that might determine a much higher number, which in and of itself I think is probably an okay calculation. I'm not 100% sure that I wanted to spend $300 million to not use it. And so the reason I put the capital held out is you don't actually know what your capital might be, but you know you'll need some return on it, and that capital may or may not be proportional to what the expected claims and the standard deviation tell you. So you can see that estimates appear several times in this formula. We have to estimate the expected level of claims. We do this by either using statistical models ranging in complexity and often based on past claims experience, or physical models of the claims process, often merged with engineering models and scientific models. And this is where we rely on the work of many of you in the audience going forward. And we need to calculate expenses, which also I didn't mention inflation, which is one of the great imponderables for us over the next few years, because you would assume, given what's happened in governmental quantitative easing and the rest, sooner or later interest rates are going to have to go up. We also need to look at repair costs, raw materials, regulatory compliance, medical costs, legal fees, general inflation. And then if we look at that, I think you'll find that almost every one of those items has quite a bit of uncertainty that we have to try and figure out a thoughtful way to manage and organize. So one of the things that you get if you do the actuarial risks, such as car accidents, there's plenty of traffic collisions that allow us to fine-tune our estimates, but if you're doing an earthquake, it's hard to get that estimate right. And in fact, if you looked at RMS, one of the larger model vendors, in the Northridge earthquake that happened some years ago in California, that was on a fault line that wasn't in the model. So the notion of parameter risk and the rest is quite something. So if you look at the sources of model uncertainty, these are the big three headers, and credit to Peter Taylor from Oxford for this, because I thought this was the most compact way to describe all these different sources of uncertainty. And where I used to work, we probably overweighted parameter risk. You know, people were complaining about why didn't the model show the Tohoku earthquake in it. And actually, there was almost exactly the same earthquake and tsunami following it 883 years ago. But most people don't look in their models past the 1 in 500 year mark. So it was there, but nobody spent a lot of time worrying about that and managing their risk. Having said that, through what we do at Lloyd's with realistic disaster scenarios, we were actually able to get people to have some assumptions about the uncertainty that meant we were well above what the actual insured losses were from the Tohoku quake. Then you have calculation error, you have the model risk, you have model inadequacy. When you look at the data, do you even have the right locations in your model? And that happens way more than I'd like to say it does in what's supposed to be a very well-run industry. Understated values. You can have overstated values, particularly when it comes to ships and vessels, where they're reported at quite a bit more than their actual value. Building risk profile. You know, the RMS changed its model because they found that when the hurricanes came over the schools in Florida, if you had a curved-up roof, then it did a little bit better than if you had a flat roof, because then it just peeled back like the top of a sardine can. And then, of course, you have the school boards in the various Florida school districts coming to me and saying they think the model's unfair to them. So what can we do to help? The schedule of risk is out of date. Secondary perils are other things that go along with it. If the building goes down, do you have business interruption insurance, things of that? Contingent business interruption is not only if something bad happens to you, it's where something bad happens to your supplier 3,500 miles away. And you get some cover for that, and we're supposed to take that risk, and it's a bit uncertain. And you've seen the Japanese insurers after the Thai floods go from a just-in-time mentality to a just-in-case mentality and shifting things. So the key point I'd like to make and have you remember is we scrutinize the members of our market and their use of models to ensure that they understand the strengths and weaknesses of those models, the nuances and the appropriateness of fit for the model against the portfolio. We also seek to ensure that these uncertainty factors around the use of the models is communicated very effectively to the board of the underwriting entity when they're telling them, here's the number of a model. And we actually come up with a willing to lose number, in a sense, on a big event, likely a California quake, Florida wind, European wind, Japanese quake. Those are our five biggest events as we look at our portfolio. And the franchise board at Lloyd's wants to know pretty often how often Trevor Maynard and I think that will happen, and if so, just what exactly would be the economic loss from that. And we have minimum standards on underwriting and claims at Lloyd's that have as an aspect the fact we'd like you to give somebody a frame of reference for when we tell you you might lose $4 billion in this event in a 1 in 200 chance. What are the uncertainty factors around that so you can actually calibrate that? So one of the things I think as an industry, and perhaps we could use some help from science and other industries, is could we have a language that's a little easier to explain to folks who don't do this every day? Now, I'm a big fan of job security as much as the next guy, and jargon is one of your key ways of getting it. But I think it would be fabulous if we could try and simplify language or make the concepts pretty commonly understood so that we could use them across businesses and across industries so that people could have a better chance of making things happen. Now, I don't have any line management authority over Lloyd's underwriters, but I do have some sanctions I can bring to bear if a business threatens to the market as a whole. On the whole, it seems to me to be pretty preferable to try and use logic and persuasion wherever possible. I describe myself, I have a job sort of like I'm the mayor and the sheriff, and I could tell you to rearrange your living room furniture if I had a mind to. But I think the right way to get people to do it is to appeal to logic and common sense, and most people do want to do the right thing. And most everybody who works at Lloyd's would like to somehow or another figure out how to take on this uncertainty risk from the rest of the economy and maybe make a little bit of money out of it. But I don't have any formal expertise in the communication of uncertainty, but I think a number of you do. So while I think I'm doing an okay job of cajoling people to do the right thing, I think I could use some help from you all in this jargon front and in terms of the help I've already gotten in the way we try to explain concepts. As much as anything, given the answer is uncertain, can you tell me how you're thinking about it? And can you tell me where the boundaries of what you're going to do to your net worth and others? So we're not running a failure-free regime. We expect people to occasionally blow up because we're taking the events from everybody else in the economy that can let them blow up. And so what I do want to make sure is that if you blow yourself up due to this uncertainty, you blow yourself up within a defined amount, which is the capital you put up. On top of that, we have another $2.4 billion in cash that we can just go to pay claims, so you should not worry about Lloyd's paying a claim. But we do want to make sure people are sensible about what we're doing, and we look at systemic risk. And one of those systemic risks is, in a sense, the model use. One of our model vendors has 38 out of our 54 agencies as its customers. So if there's a flaw in that model, I've got it all over the place. So that's one of the reasons we encourage other models. We've encouraged the OASIS project for, in a sense, open cap modeling and the rest, all of which where we're trying to get people to have multiple views of this uncertainty. So basically, when you could think about pricing the whole risk, you could think about doing a variety of things to address this, but perhaps a experience I had with one of the Lloyd's underwriters, which was, I walked into the committee of all the guys who take property risk, and one of the older fellows was on the left, and a bunch of young bucks were down the right. And he looked up at me and he says, "You're not the guy who's going to make me use a model, are you?" And I said, "Well, I have a lot of sympathy for your position because I tend to be pretty skeptical about parameter risk, and there's a lot of things models fit. But I think they're a very useful skeleton on which you can hang the rest of your underwriting thinking and use judgment, which is hopefully what you're getting paid for and what you've been around a long time and what you know a lot about. But I have to be honest with you, and I agree with you, a skeleton isn't a whole human, so it's not the whole decision. So you do need your underwriting thinking. But you got to be honest as well that a human without a skeleton ain't much of a human either." So he then pushed, and I said, "Okay, finally, in front of all these people, I'm going to go on record, and you can go ahead and not use a model if you want to. But I need to tell you, I know a ton about this guy over here. I've seen his business. I've looked at his models. And so when something goes pear-shaped and really bad, he actually knows which thing to fix. You don't know what to fix. You're going to have to raise your prices on everything. So he's going to spend the rest of the year picking you off. And if you'd like my permission to do that, feel free." So that's some of the opportunities we have to try and communicate how you should think about uncertainty and try and do that. Regulators and boards essentially want to know what our estimated 1 in 200 year loss is. Now, that's a bit tricky given the modern insurance industry is really only 25 to 30 years old, and earlier loss data is hard to model with any degree of confidence. And it's, you can see the different types of uncertainty at this level, which would swamp our model. And so we think there's a real challenge to trying to do this 1 in 200, and we think it's very important to talk about the uncertainty around that number so that you don't misinterpret it. It's usually likely you're going to be over-optimistic, but occasionally you can be over-pessimistic, which is just as damaging in certain circumstances. So the other thing in iMarket, it may surprise you to hear, is people tend to be gifted with a lot of confidence in their opinions. And that's sort of fun. And in fact, the board members usually are pretty confident too. So you get this psychological dynamic of people trying to swap stories about how bad things could get, but they don't want to say it's so bad so they get fired. But they don't want to say it's, you know, they want to have some truthfulness to it. And so Trevor Maynard, who works with me on this, with the actuaries involved and the rest, realizes there's a difficulty in communicating the uncertainty in a way that is effective, but not career limiting. And so we try to work with those two psychological challenges. And our job, we figure, is to hold the hand of the people who are trying to do it right so the boards don't lose their nerve and they don't lose their nerve, and to encourage those who are tempted to be overconfident in their forecasting to perhaps take another look. And we try to maximize the market skill and understanding of the data they do have. And we look mainly at things that are systemic, focus on areas that present the biggest danger to the market as a whole. And chief among these are the big accumulation of property values in the zones I just mentioned. And we have some pretty good tools, and so do the people in the market. A number of people some who are here tonight, some who I thought might be here tonight, have written some very useful papers to us, for us in the business. And they also have a healthy skepticism of the models, their strengths and weaknesses. We look at business plans. They try and tell us what they think they're going to take in risk. We measure what they do take in risk. We look at how the shape of that risk is. And so you can look at sort of the uncertainty premium that goes around that. So the way I sort of look at it, the market and what we do for it, is we are working with merchants of uncertainty. And we try to figure out how to make sure that they're not taking overwhelming risks with what we have in our capital and our promise to pay, because that's the best thing we have about Lloyd's is 325 years of paying every legitimate promise to pay. And after 325 years, I don't want to be the guy who sort of blows it, to be candid. But it's a pretty strong institution and a lot stronger than any one individual. And another way to help you think about this, there's some papers you can read about the theory, and it's sort of the difference between playing golf and playing golf for money. The underwriters at Lloyd's are playing golf for money, and they trade in uncertainty. And I really appreciate your interest tonight, and I want you to remember we rely on your work. So thank you, and please keep it up.